Hi folks, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll. Welcome you to the latest podcast from the Banter team. It's 5 years since civil war broke out in Syria. In those 5 years, hundreds of thousands of Syrian people have been killed and millions more have been displaced in the brutal conflict between Assad and those opposed to his rule. We were joined at Banter by Gold's Chief Executive Barry Andrews, Médecins Sans Frontières Ireland Director Jane Anne McKenna, and author of My Home is Your Home, A Journey Around Syria, travel writer Mary Russell, to talk about the human and cultural cost of the conflict to date.
Hi folks. Welcome along to Banter number 129 here at MVP. My name is Jim Carroll. Thank you very, very much for coming out tonight. It's great to see so many people interested in this topic. We're joined here by three people who are going to speak about Syria. One of the people we have here is Mary Russell. She's an amazing writer and author, and she has got some copies of her books for sale down the door, so we'll be selling those at the break. Just some housekeeping while I remembered. We'll have a discussion first of all, probably 40, 45 minutes, and then we'll take a break so you can just kind of, I suppose, get some air and stretch your legs, and then we'll come back and get some questions from the audience. So our three guests tonight are Jane Anne McKenna, who is Médecins Sans Frontières Ireland's director. Next to her, there is Barry Andrews, who's the chief executive of GOAL. And last but not least, we got Mary Russell, travel writer and author. Please give them a warm round of applause. Let's start with you, Jane Anne. Talk to us a little bit about what MSF are up to in Syria, how long you've been there, and I suppose the changing conditions you've come across, especially in the last 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, so MSF, we started working in August 2011 inside Syria, and we've never actually received permission from the Syrian authorities to actually work inside the country. So our operations began very much clandestinely, so very much working across the border, supporting medical networks, doctors that were working inside and supplying them with materials. And it was at the beginning, these structures were more or less in caves, in underground apartments. And as the time has gone on, they've become slightly more sophisticated, the medical facilities that we do support. And since 2011, we were able to build up actually our presence in northern Syria particularly. And at one point, you know, we were running fully functional about six hospitals, as well as supporting about 150 networks and medical facilities as well. After a number of our staff were kidnapped by ISIS in early 2014, and there's five international staff kidnapped and subsequently released after 6 months, but we had to really we faced a decision then that we could no longer work in ISIS-controlled areas. We could not get any assurances from any of the commanders that our presence there would be respected and that we'd be able to continue with our work without being at risk. So we are now, in fact, still operating about four hospitals inside Syria directly, but primarily really supporting this network of doctors. And what that means is that, you know, over the last 4 years, we've built up very close relationships with groups, all Syrians who are working inside the country, inside besieged areas, and over 50% of the hospitals that we do support are inside besieged areas. And we're giving them, you know, we're supplying them with technical advice and assistance through Skype, WhatsApp, and everything else, but also sending in supplies, sending in medicine, sending in medical equipment as well. And that in itself is an extremely dangerous operation. You know, I think we know from the decree from the Syrian government in 2012 that, you know, it is considered illegal to to provide any level of medical care in the opposition-controlled areas. So those who we work with and those who we support face imminent danger, really, if they are caught treating patients. And that's the situation today, unfortunately, for a lot of people who are risking their lives, really, to support others and to treat people on the ground.
Okay, excellent. Well, Barry, talk to us about GOAL then. I mean, how long have you been in? And, what's the scale of your operations in Syria at the moment?
Jim, the GOAL is there since October 2012, so a little bit after MSF. And we work in the rebel-held area as well, in northwestern Syria. The extent of the operation is beyond anything we've ever done. So it's the largest operation in the history of GOAL. And it is, we're reaching 1 million people per annum. So in 2015, we reached 1 million people. Now, the kind of work we're doing, we don't support hospitals, although that may change very soon in relation to a hospital in Bab al-Hawa that we've been asked to support. But the main work we do is food security. So we provide, initially we did very basic stuff around the provision of food baskets to vulnerable families, but more recently distributing vouchers, which gives people choice, allows the support for local markets. We're also doing water remediation work, which is itself very, very interesting work, because when water pipes aren't working, 70% of income goes on purchasing water. So when we can get the pipes going, we can get generators working, we can understand the topography and everything goes with it, that makes a massive transformative change to the people that are living there. And now there's an awful lot of internally displaced people that have moved up to our area of operations. Now that area now is under extreme pressure. The Turks have more or less closed the border. The pressure from high military Russian ordnance is much greater than anything that the Assad regime was able to manage in the last 4 or 5 years. So it's a really, really appalling situation right now. There's only one border crossing left. And the real tragedy for us as GOAL is we've lost 3 members of staff in the last year, which is really devastating. We have 380 Syrians working for us in GOAL, and for them to lose their friends and colleagues in that way is really devastating. But they're determined to work. They're determined to continue the provision of aid that they do. They're extremely independent, neutral. They won't tolerate any interference from any of the military factions that are operational in our areas. So hopefully that gives you a picture, Jim, of or the extent of our operations.
Okay, thank you, Barry. Mary, you're coming from a different perspective. You were telling me before we started that you were last there in 2010 before it kicked off. You mean your book, My Home Is My Home Is Your Home, My Home Is Your Home, sorry, is basically, it tells you a story of kind of like, I mean, that particular travels and what you saw in Syria at that particular time. How do you, like, I mean, like, what Jane Anne and Barry are talking about is, like, I mean, they're talking about the human cost, the destruction that's going on. You see a different kind of cost that this kind of war has brought about.
Yeah, well, is it on?
Yeah.
I went there in 2000, and I had been planning to go. I'd applied for a visa and so on, but I had said that I was a journalist and a writer, and I was told you shouldn't say that because your application will go into a drawer in Damascus and it would never be heard of again. That seemed to be the state of affairs. And then I met a Palestinian, and I've worked in Palestine, so I had a kind of in there, and this guy was... a member of the Arab League in London, and he said, I'll see if I can help, and he did, and I then got my visa. And from the point of view of just simply travelling around, are we getting a chance to talk again about what we've been doing?
Oh, you're right, okay.
Because I've made copious notes, which I want to inflict on everybody. what I did find was that I had to be a little bit circumspect about myself and what I was doing and so on. But I did tell the people that I was working with that I was writing a book. But, you know, I was followed once or twice, there's no doubt about that. And on one occasion, I always used, by the way, the British Council facilities. Any country that I'm in, I head for the British Council. They have lovely clean lavatories, and they usually have a library and use their library, and maybe a little coffee shop and so on. So I used the one in Damascus, which fulfilled everything, all my expectations. But I was chatting to a woman, and she said, by the way, just maybe, you know, be careful of what you say just now. And a man had come in and sat down. Now, he didn't look like a student at all. He was in a suit, and he didn't even have a rucksack or anything. He had a little briefcase. It just didn't look fit the bill of a student at all. And after a while, he moved to sit in the table where the front row is, just exactly there, so that he could look right opposite us. And I thought, well, you're not very, very good at your job. I can see what you're doing. And after a while, he went, and the friend said, well, he wouldn't have understood what we were saying anyway, because we were
so
talking.
That was 2010, was it?
That was that was right. That was in 2000. That was when I first went there. Yeah.
So you've been there a few times. So did when you were there the last time in 2010? Did you notice, Mary, things were changing? I mean, how did it kind of manifest itself?
Well, I think I mentioned to you that I was in 2010. I happened to be walking along. I really loved the city. I got to know it very well. That's Damascus now, from just walking around it. And I saw a car which had a sign, one of these things you put on the back of your car, advertising something, and it said in very large letters, "We are proud to be Syrian." And I thought, well, that's interesting. Now, why do they need to say that? It's a good thing to say, but why do they need to say it? So I went and knocked on the door of the office outside where the car was, and they were... They were a graphic artist company, and I asked them what it was all about, and they explained to me that they wanted change. They said, "We would like things to change, but we're all loyal to our president." And that was the message that I took away with me in 2010 when I left. That was a positive message, a demand for change, or a request for change. And of course, as we all know, everything went haywire after that.
Yeah, well, that's kind of like a good way of putting it. Everything went haywire. You know, and often when you're searching for a solution, the first place to start is actually where the problem begins in the first place. You know, what Mary's just described there, you know, that feeling on one hand of looking for change, on the other hand of kind of like, I suppose, an adherence and a loyalty to the Assad regime. When you look back at where it all started, can you, on the ground, like Barry and Jenna, can you actually see the causes? Can you see the kind of the crack lines where they actually came from in the first place?
Jean, I'll jump in. There is a lot of thought around this, and one of the causes, apart from the governance and the general Arab Spring and the contagion effect of the other countries that were demonstrating, there is also a theory around climate change, in fact, where there was considerable drought in 2010 and 2011. A lot of people moved out of rural areas, agricultural workers into the cities, and they became the energy behind the protest movement. There was also serious increases in bread prices and food prices generally. So that discontent in Syria was perhaps related back a little bit tenuously, but certainly it's interesting to think about these things nowadays. You know, when you look at the larger geopolitical structure issues, you know, that climate change is associated with so many things, like, for example, Typhoon Haiyan, which experienced incredible intensity because of global warming, and equally the war in Syria. And there are some that would relate the global pandemic of Ebola to urbanization, to the fact that many of the places where animals were and that are infecting humans are shrinking. So there's an interrelatedness there, and an interesting development, and it really just underlines the importance of dealing with those bigger issues.
That's a very large macro issue. Like, I mean, in terms of kind of like in Syria, in terms of kind of like, I suppose, the response to that kind of Arab Spring, which was going on, and especially like, I mean, I suppose the Assad regime. Like, what looking back now, can either of you kind of like, I mean, see those kind of like those fault lines developing?
I think, you know, from a lot of the young Syrians that I've met, you know, whether it be in Jordan or in Iraq as well, particularly those who were involved in the fighting, you know, and this is over a couple of years ago even, and, you know, there is that sense of after, I suppose, that first kind of, you know, burst, and I suppose how it was being dealt with by the Assad regime, you know, there was a huge level of frustration and a huge level of disillusionment as well. And I think where you had what we were seeing ourselves is that, you know, the conflict did definitely change over time. At the beginning, there was very much, when we were treating people, you know, obviously there's a lot of gunshot, but there was a lot of torture going on as well. And I think that was happening at quite a large scale level across Syria. And then it became a bit more prevalent in terms of the level of violence and that was happening. And indeed, the level of injuries that we were seeing then were coming out to be kind of more and more out now conflict-based as opposed to kind of behind closed doors. Mm. But it was evident that definitely at the beginning stages of the conflict, that's what we were seeing. And I think that was essentially growing and growing underneath the surface really for some time.
Mm. Barry, what about, like, I mean, the I suppose the number of players in the conflict right now? I mean, that's something as an outsider looking in, that strikes me, that myself and Mary were talking about this earlier on, that it just seems to be so many different factions that, like, you're kind of wondering, like, are factions kind of like splitting? Are factions kind of like developing new kind of cells all the time?
Yeah, I mean, our security people would keep us up to date around the numbers of factions, and in single towns, you're going to find multiple factions, actually. Last year, around this time of the year, many of the factions came together into what was become the Army of Conquest at the bidding of Saudi Arabia, but they have fractured again. So interfactional fighting has increased quite a lot in the last quarter of 2015 and the last couple of months as well. We estimate there are about 97 factions in Idlib province alone. So it gives you some idea of the diversity and the almost impossibility of trying to reach consensus on a cessation of hostilities. Mm. So, I mean, that's just at ground level, at microscopic level. Then you can peel away the onion and you end up with Russia and America. You know, everybody is killing each other over this.
Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's what I'm saying. There's layers to this, all the way from the global to the very village level.
Divisions. Okay, take that number there, Barry. You kind of said 97 different factions. What separates them? I mean, are we talking Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael here? Are we talking about something a lot more
something much more serious than that? No, they are virtually ideologically not separated from each other. There are moderate. Groups. There are secular groups. I mean, let's be clear. At the very beginning, this was a secular rebellion. It was a secular civil disorder. A civil resistance before it became militarized, and the government became very aggressive. They then began to arm themselves almost for self-defense, and that morphed because there was nobody coming to their aid. They looked to buy weapons. They found that there was no support for them, so they were doing things like smuggling. They were smuggling diesel. They were actually selling artifacts from some of the most historical parts that Mary would have come across in her travels to try and generate funds. And then ISIS arrive, backed up with serious ordnance that are actually able to resist the Assad government. And so the radicalization wasn't an ideological thing. It was a very practical reaction to the absence of any proper support, if you like, for those people that were opposing the government in the early stages of the conflict. So the more it went on, there was more fragmentation among the opposition. The more it went on, there was more radicalization among the opposition, which got to the stage of, I think, around 2013, when there were some opportunities then to try to do something about it, but they were missed.
Mary, you have your own theories about why the conflict happened and why it spread so fast.
I think I was aware, certainly, that there was a lot of things going on that I didn't necessarily know about and that people didn't want to talk about. For instance, in Tadmor, which is the little town that's stuck onto Palmyra, there was an underground prison, and it was known that there were people there. Now, that was closed down by Assad and then reopened again. But there were certainly examples of hardly a family that hasn't been touched in some way by the whole thing. And if you just go back a little bit to 1982, when there was a Muslim Brotherhood and others rising against the government, and the Assad family, or the government rather, came in and laid waste to the city. And when I was there, you could see that they had rebuilt it because they didn't want to lose the support of the people. But there were great gaps and gashes in the city, which had been caused by the bombing, and that was 1982. And the people would lower their voices when they were talking to me. But I was there to see Syria as it was then. So although I was aware of it, and one of the things, of course, that I always, when I'm in Syria, people ask me, two questions they always ask me was, Madame, from where you are, and Madame, how old you are. That was the regular. When I came back to Ireland, people said, was it safe? And in fact, for a woman, for anybody, it was incredibly safe. I got a taxi one time from Baghdad, overnight taxi, who dropped me off at 3:30 in the morning in Damascus, and I was able to walk through the streets to get my hotel and so on. That's how safe it was. But I had always, and it's in one of the pages in my book, that I had to remind myself that it was indeed safe, but there were people paying the price for that safety, which had not to be forgotten.
Exactly, and that's something you mentioned earlier on, then, Jenan. Like, you know, it strikes me as well that, like, this conflict is really, really bitter and very, very vicious. You know, aside from the things which happen behind closed doors, that kind of police brutality that you saw, your doctor saw the evidence of, there's also the use of siege and starvation techniques. There's also the use of kind of chemical warfare. You know, compare it to other conflicts. Is it particularly bitter? Is it the bitterest thing you've come across?
Well, I think it's for MSF, it's how we're operating now in Syria is unlike any other operations that we've had to do. And I'm sure that's the same. I'm just reiterating as well, the same for GOAL. You know, we've had to really be very innovative in trying to think of how we can actually try and reach people because of all the barriers that are in our way, because there is absolutely no respect for any sort of upholding, you know, any international humanitarian law or the right to actually give humanitarian assistance. Also, you know, we've seen ourselves, you know, a lot of, I think we've, the hospitals we support, you know, in 2015, there was over 90 were attacked, you know, in shelling or bombing. So, you know, there's a direct attack on hospitals that's happening. And I think that, you know, what we've seen in Madaya as well, these kind of siege tactics in East Ghouta with the chemical weapons as well. You know, there is really, you know, we know now there's about 2 million people under siege in Syria today, and there's no real way in or out. And it's not even about being able to provide medical assistance to those people or being able to get supplies in, but even just the basic provisions of food or, you know, clean water or any other kind of anything really subsistence in order to live is very much not there. And there's really no way for international organizations to get in there. You know, it's very difficult. It's extremely unsafe. And it's, again, you know, it's a question mark constantly internally within MSF. We've taken out international staff from inside Syria, but we are very aware of the risks that those who we are supporting are taking on a daily basis, you know, and it's very much, you know, what level of responsibility do we have towards those that we are supporting in terms of, because we know that 23 of those of staff that we were supporting last year were killed. So, you know, we are saying that we need to look at some of the risks that are taking, but weighing up, you know, what other alternatives are there if we do want to provide some level of assistance, you know, what else can we do? And I think if you look, one of the ways that we've tried to also support is that in Jordan, for example, we have a surgical hospital literally 1 kilometer away from the Syrian border. So we have essentially the wounded come essentially fresh from Syria. We have people in Syria have our phone number and also the Jordanian civil defense, and we get calls overnight when people are need to come across the border to actually get surgical care. And it's kind of looking at means like that in order to be able to provide assistance if we cannot physically have a massive presence on the ground, what else we can do to actually provide that level of essential medical care to actually save some lives. Yeah.
I mean, that picture that Jane Anne has just described there is pretty horrific. I mean, like, you know, to us here in kind of like the Western world, like, we've all got problems, but, like, you know, compared to those kind of problems, there's nothing. Talk a bit, Barry, maybe about, like, I mean, the macro side of things. You mentioned earlier on there about, like, ISIS, and then there's kind of, like, I mean, obviously, there's Russia kind of, like, and Putin coming in, supporting Assad with kind of, like, with bombardments. There's also kind of America. Like, Do you see any sort of, like, I mean, is the kind of the international level of engagement, the international level of negotiations, is it sufficient? Is it adequate?
Not at all. I would say, just on Jane Anne's last point, you know, I was down in Turkey there last week and talked to some medics who are like, they're actually Turkish authorities, but they get chemical injuries all the time, but they know where it's from. If it's a mustard gas, it's IS. If it's chlorine, it's government. So when they've got used to dealing with it, it's kind of ho-hum for them. They see it all the time, and we hear about it very irregularly here in the West. So, you know, this is going on all the time. Let's be clear about it. It happened very dramatically in August of 2013, and this was the famous red line that was crossed, and, you know, a permission slip is handed to the Syrian authorities to go ahead and do whatever they wanted from then on. And it was clear that the Americans didn't have the stomach to do anything, and Putin saw his opportunity. So, you know, what the Russians are doing in Syria is very interesting. They're the only ones that are lawfully there in international law, which highlights how strange international law really is, because they have no respect for humanitarian workers. They have, you know, they're trying to seal off the border, which is the one area where we as GOAL are able to get supplies in. But they are lawfully there because they were invited into Syria by the government. We're not lawfully there. MSF aren't lawfully there. Neither are the Americans or the British. Unless you're a genius lawyer in the British government and you can justify it in some way. But so there is not enough activity. What happened at the end of September of 2015 was that the Russians began a bombardment. And I thought at that time, well, maybe this will bring people to their senses. Maybe the Americans will be forced to actually take this a bit more seriously. So for the 18 months before that, there had been virtually no diplomatic, political initiatives, no energy whatsoever. But once the Russians started getting involved, to everybody's shock and horror, then there was energy, then there was discussions for the first time in 18 months. Now, it's such a complicated issue, but there's certainly more energy in the last 6 months than there has been in the previous 18 months. But unfortunately, Europe is looking at this from the perspective of two issues. One, refugee movements, and the other, ISIS and terrorist threats. But they are two downstream consequences of the real issue, which is the war in Syria. Mm. And so long as you spend more attention on those symptoms and not the core issue, then you're going to continue to have those symptoms repeated over and over again with greater intensity. So I would say that, yes, there really isn't enough diplomatic activity. But hopefully, when President Trump is elected, it'll all be sorted out. They haven't suffered enough.
May, what's your take on where things can go from here? You know, as someone who's been there and who's written kind of like me very eloquently about like the culture of the country, the fact that like me so much of that culture now has just been blown to smithereens. Look, what's your take on where things can go from here?
I think it's been blown to smithereens. I mean, some of the statues have been destroyed, which is heartbreaking, it's true. But the people themselves have not been destroyed. And I think I've got great faith in the people of Syria that I met, whether they're still there or whether they've left. And I go back in history, and I don't want to go back too far, but if you look at, say, around about 1200, I think it was, they were overrun by one group of people. 200 years later, another lot, Timur the Lane, and they burned the whole of Damascus and Aleppo. They were wooden houses then, so you quite easily to destroy them. They had that. They've had earthquakes. They've had the First World War when they were carved. The country was carved up. They've had Israel encroach and take part of the Golan Heights. They had the Second World War. They've managed to actually make themselves into an independent country, which was great. And just one thing that I'd like to say about that is that in 1947 it was that Syria became independent and declared itself a state, and a secular state. I don't think the idea of secularism is something new. It was definitely there when they set themselves up officially as a secular state, an Arab state, which bad news for the Kurds, of course. But that is what happened. And I've seen a kind of spirit of survival there. And I give you one, when we talk about destruction of buildings and so on, I was in Hama, which was destroyed, most of it. And I visited the old mosque there, which is very similar to the one in Damascus, but not as grandiose, and for some reason or other I liked that a bit better because it was very, very plain. And that was destroyed in 1982 by the government forces. But they started to build, the people of Hamas started to rebuild it, and they were able to build it exactly as it had been because somebody with some kind of forethought had saved the plans from the 11th century, and they were able to rebuild their mosque using those. So that to me tells me that there is something there in the spirit of Syria, and there are lots of Syrians I think will agree with me. Have we got anybody from Syria here? No, which is a pity, but there we are. And because the people who've said to me, you know, we want change, but we're loyal to our president, there are plenty of people who are actually still there in Syria and in Damascus especially, of course, because that's where things are not quite so bad.
The back of Mary's point, Mary, is that, you know, they do want to, the ones that have left the country for between 2011 and 2014, before the tide of refugees came here, they didn't leave the region because they wanted to go back. You know, they didn't start coming until it was they give up hope and they started thinking, well, this isn't ending soon. This could be like the Lebanese civil war that went on for 15 years. It's time to move on. So their original intention was either internally displaced or move into the neighbouring countries temporarily. And their intention was to go back. And the passion for their country, you know, they are attached to the land. There's grandparents that are still there. There's relatives in a country where family is so important, where place is as important as we attach to it, of course it is.
Yeah.
And the history of the place. I mean, you know, where our head office is in Idlib province in Syria, it's a town called Haram. And there's a sort of a hillock outside, just in the centre town, where there's a Roman ruins. I was able to get in there very briefly and about 2 or 3 years ago, and you know, just tides and tides of history that have gone through that part of the world. For example, the last place in the world where the language of Jesus is still spoken is in, which is Aramaic, is in Syria. Mm. So you're talking about the cradle of so much of everything we, you know, we our history.
As you're speaking, as Mary was speaking, I'm just kind of thinking that, like, I mean, for many decades and centuries, the Syrian people got on with it. You know, that there wasn't that sort of, like, I mean, the viciousness we've seen right now. You mentioned there about, like, I mean, when it became an independent country, well, apart from the poor Kurds, mm-hmm. you talked there about 97 different factions. And I'm kind of thinking, like especially kind of, well, why did it become so bitter so fast? And why are all these divisions suddenly there? I mean, it's just I suppose I'm being a bit of a devil's advocate here, but I'm just kind of wondering, like, why did this integrate so quickly?
Well, I think, like, something what Barry mentioned earlier is that, you know, because there was no real willingness to actually get involved in the Syrian conflict from an international perspective for quite some time, that within the opposition, you know, that they became very fractured very quickly, you know, that people are, like anything, it was a case of, there was years of violence there between the Syrian government and the different opposition groups. And, you know, when it got very fragmented very quickly, because suddenly then resources get more depleted, you know, people are arguing against their neighbours, about other towns, it becomes about power, it gets about control as well. So, you know, you saw to some level, you know, people are resisting against ISIS, you know, particularly within the opposition, but within themselves, is that it gets to that very kind of, I wouldn't say quite local level, but it's just, you know, if there was no real intervention coming from an international perspective, you know, that people were essentially trying to protect their own and protect their own town, their own village, and trying to do what they felt was in the best interest, you know. And there is, like that, I don't think in ideology there is any major differences between a lot of the factions, but it does become an element of control then as well, yeah, you know, okay. When there's limited resources, yeah.
There's a great book, a lady called Samar Yazbek, I don't know if any of you have heard of it, but it's it describes, she goes over to Syria three times. She's Parisian, well, she's Syrian but living in Paris, and she goes over three times in a period of 2013 to 2014, and each visit you can see the decline, you know, from secularism to radicalization, from a unified free Syrian army to, you know, every town, whatever you're having yourself, and despairing, you know, and she keeps going back. And the amazing story is that she was among all of the Sunni anti-Assad opposition, but she was herself Alawite. And she had, I mean, it's an incredible story, and her passion for her country really burns off the page. But it really does describe that point that Jane Anne is making, that, you know, the radicalization came slowly. It wasn't, you know, instinctive, yeah. It wasn't reflexive, it was a practical response to the lack of any support.
And I think also there was a bit of a vacuum which allowed other groups to move in across the border from Iraq and take control of this, their part of the situation.
Yeah. I mean, again, like, I mean, you mentioned there as well, Barry. You said that, like, you know, that European governments and world governments are looking at kind of like this double threat. Be it, like, I mean, trust the right word in the case of ISIS, but, like, I mean, in case of the refugees as well. That's kind of, like, I mean, the most, I suppose, you know, apparent sign to Western people of what's going on. These millions of, like, the Syrians who are moving kind of like to Europe, you know. And it's like, do you think, for example, that let's leave ISIS alone for a few minutes, but let's say in terms of the refugees, that deal that was struck this week by the EU with Turkey. Is that going to have an effect, or is it? Are basically you
if it
basically
if it happens,
yeah. But even if it happens, like, I mean, is it a case though that, I mean, the poor Syrians are just kind of swapping, you know, one disaster for another? You know, can Turkey kind of like keep track of all this?
Well, I think, like, if you look at the deal, I think it's about the €3 billion deal from the EU to Turkey, you know, to keep the Syrians out. You know, it's very much. The UNHCR declared Turkey in 2014 as not a safe country, you know, so essentially, you know, the EU is kind of contradicting its own values, you know, of what that it's trying to uphold, particularly with regards to, you know, international humanitarian law and in regards to the rights of refugees. And, you know, I think that there's a serious question mark over, you know, the ethics, obviously, and even the legality of what the EU is trying to do at the moment with Turkey. And I think that by by throwing kind of money at the situation and trying to ensure that, you know, there's no longer the EU's problem anymore, is actually not upholding what is essentially, you know, our, what we have signed up to in terms of our duty towards refugees. And we've seen that the, you know, this whole quota system completely collapsed. You know, there's so many discussions that happened over that absolutely nothing came of it. I think maybe 30 people might have arrived into Ireland so far, you know, but, you know, it, like, essentially, it, for all intents and purposes, it's completely defunct now, that whole idea. And I think, you know, there's been an active policy of deterrence that's been happening for the last couple of years and very much over the last 18 months. And, you know, this is really now just ramped up to, you know, very vocally, people, you know, maybe member states were afraid to say at the beginning, but now it's very vocal, you know, what they actually intend to do. And we saw now the border with Macedonia is now formally shut today. So we're seeing 14,000 people at that border. We've got, you know, there's 40,000 people now at the Greek border, and there's absolutely nothing, you know, it's a bit of a case of closing our eyes and saying we don't want to deal with this problem anymore, you know, and not actually, you know, actually trying to find an adequate solution to the issue.
Okay. So then, in terms of refugees, we're not pursuing anything. In terms of getting of intervening in Syria and actually, like, I mean, like working what's going on the ground, we don't seem to be prepared to do anything. So what exactly are we prepared to do? We just got, like, I mean, like, are these governments we elect or not elect, as the case may be here in Ireland? I mean, are they just kind of like ignoring it? Do all of you kind of think it was kind of like just par for the course? And Syria didn't come up once during the general election campaign here.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a vote winner, you know. But just on, you know, the points that Jane Anne is making, you know, the agreement of the week over this week was, I think, informed by German domestic politics, because Angela Merkel is under real pressure with these regional elections that are going on at the moment in one of the eastern regions. The right wing party I think Pegida are sort of 15%, and CSU are beginning to emerge, and there's a lot of her allies are beginning to vacate. And so it was very much an expedient effort. It's, in my opinion, illegal. You can't compulsory, you know, deport a whole group of people. What I can't understand is how the nature of the agreement seems to be that if 100,000 Syrians are sent from Greece to Turkey, the European Union will take 100,000 from Turkey into the European Union. So if you're a Turkish government, you're going to say, well, we send over 100,000, they'll send them back, and then they'll take them. 100,000. I mean, it's just the most extraordinary thing. And every EU agreement or decision on all of this has failed. Now, let's be clear about this. 120,000 agreed last year. Nothing happened. They were supposed to give 3 billion to the Turkish government. Not a cent of it went. There was various other initiatives were taken, and none of them achieved anything. So 2016 is going to be incredibly difficult. I think the whole political complexion in Europe is changing. And the next 3-4 weeks for Angela Merkel are very, very dangerous. I mean, they always say that about her, that she's the most cautious person in European politics. And there's only two times in her career where she did something rash. One was on getting rid of nuclear energy, and the other was open doors policy on refugees. And particularly in the second issue, she didn't create enough of a coalition among her supporters within Germany or the other member states of the European Union before making that decision. Mm. Because it was not a decision she should have taken unilaterally, because clearly it's created the mess that we have right now. Mm. Now, I don't have a solution. I think there has to be a safe system for asylum seeking for people fleeing the conflict in Syria here in the European Union. I read somebody saying a very good point today that, you know, the average GDP in Turkey is $9,000 per capita. In Europe, it's $27,000 per capita. But we can't manage a million refugees with our wealth, with our numbers, with our vast area. But Turkey can manage them. And that is that's the core of this. That's the principle of what has been agreed. And it is, I would say there's EU diplomats who are really, really finding it very difficult. I mean, they're holding their noses while making up these current agreements with the Turks, I would say.
I mean, it's human rights outsourcing, you know, and like it's outsourcing what's the problem to basically a regime which is just as questionable, maybe, which in some ways is as Assad ever was.
Yeah, I mean, I've described it as refugee laundering. You know, they're moving around in sort of circular places and not really. I mean, they're stateless. You're sending Syrians back to Turkey where they can't apply for asylum. they don't get travel documents. I mean, the Turks, in fairness to them, are looking after them extremely well, providing them with schooling, with healthcare, with the right to work, but they don't have the right to apply for asylum. So they never get citizenship or in the normal refugee system. So that is a breach of the Geneva Convention. All of the EU member states are signatories of that convention, and therefore, you know, there are endless reasons why it's the wrong approach. The only reason it's the right approach is because there are German elections coming up.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, while the international community, the EU diplomats, and the German politicians all kind of like just play past the parcel. Back home in Syria, meanwhile, it's just like the conflict goes on. You know, and I'm curious. Like, I mean, Mary.
Well, wait. Now the conflict. We have reached a point where people are sitting down somewhere or other to talk, and we may be. I'm not terribly pessimistic about it. I do think that there is a possibility. Now, you said this year is going to be, Barry, an important year, and I think it could well be as well. But I think that if we have any hopes for anything that might come out of the present cessation of violence and also the possibility of the peace talks, is that we've really got to be prepared for the fact that it's going to take a long time. I was thinking about this afternoon. It took something like 4 years for the Northern Ireland agreement to come through. 4 years, and more part of them, they're still hanging in together. Five political parties. We couldn't do that here. And in South Africa, it was something like 27 years that Nelson Mandela was in. And I was in. There's somebody else here as well. I was one of the observers there, and one of the things I learned about it was that the ANC educated their people very, very well, and one of the things they educated them was about consulting their members. So when you had coming up to the election, when you had transitional councils where you had black and white people sitting on the same council together before they actually had the main election so that they could get used to it. The white guys would say to me after, these, you know, those people, that was the black Africans, those people, they can never take a decision. They've always got to go away somewhere and talk about it. But of course they had. They'd got to go back to their own members. And I said to this guy, well, yeah, that's called democracy. I mean, it's not great. And I think that yeah, there's a whole lot of self-education having to go on in the whole peace process with Syria as well, and it will be very, very, a very, very heart-searching time, because one of the most important things I think is that these talks, if they do get off the ground, will have to be inclusive. We can't just pick and choose. Yeah, we wanted that. We like that group. Yeah, we'll have them. Well, we don't like them. We don't have them. All those people have got to have a say somehow or other, or be represented in the talks.
So, do we reckon then that one of those players that sing down to table will be ISIS?
And I think ISIS are so, would be nihilistic that there doesn't seem to be any common ground that they can. I don't think that's a reality at all. I think that's a military solution. But I think there are opportunities, definitely on the diplomatic political front in respect of all of the other parties. And while they are affiliated with all sorts of very odd groups, I think I would repeat that I think their affiliations are very practical and not necessarily ideological. And when it comes to the point where there are tangible confidence-building measures beginning to emerge, then I think factions will see the opportunity, and they'll be informed by their own people. I mean, the people of Syria, as Mary's pointed out, they want peace, for God's sake, and they want to think about their future, and they want to educate their children, and they want to go back to their farms, their land, and their grandparents, and all the communities that they had pre-war, and many of them got on very well with each other, regardless of religion. So, that's the hope. That's where the energy is going to come from. And I think the Russians don't want to be embroiled forever in this situation, because they have their own Muslim minorities within the Russian Federation. And so there's quite possible you could sort of begin to identify common ground in terms of the common interests of the Americans and the Russians here to try and create the energy for a diplomatic solution.
Yeah.
And that has been absent for a long time.
Do you agree with that kind of summation, Jane Anne? That's the only way you can kind of deal with ISIS will be through a military way?
I don't know if I attempt to know anything about any military strategies, but I think, I think even from our own engagement with ISIS over the last number of years, you know, like what Barry was saying, you know, it is not... there is really no common ground. And we've struggled with this as well. We've had numerous discussions, you know, are we willing to even negotiate with ISIS? Are we willing to try and do anything just to work in those areas? Because don't forget, like in the areas that they control, you know, there definitely is no international aid going in, you know. We really don't know what's happening in a lot of those areas, apart from the reports that we see in the media. So, you know, it's a struggle that we face ourselves. You know, is it good enough for us to say that, no, we just can't work there anymore? Or do we have to keep on questioning that? But like that, there is no real common ground in terms of, you know, human decency, in terms of any respect of law. So I'm not sure. I agree that I think there is a potential, hopefully, you know, that there a diplomatic solution can be found to the crisis in Syria today. I do think ISIS, however, is another story.
And I agree with Mary Ann, but Jane Ann, is that I was at a conference, you know, with humanitarian people, and one guy in the group, he said, you know, you end up talking to all terrorists eventually, and which was a bit of a sharp intake of breath, you know, everybody was thinking, and he identified there are only two terrorist groups in the world that nobody's talking to, which is Boko Haram and ISIS. Yeah. So, you know, in practicalities, you can't see any possible solution other than a military.
I've got to come in here. I don't know who it was you said wouldn't talk to terrorists or something, but we've done it here in Ireland, haven't we?
Yeah. That's my point. I mean,
Eventually everyone does talk. I mean, I think about ISIS, is one thing ISIS have in their favour is that they're a very sexy media story, you know? It's like, you know, they're someone who've, like, I mean, completely and utterly commandeered and commanded and actually excel in the whole area of kind of social media in getting their kind of message of hatred out there. I mean, and you can see why so many media people are kind of covering them.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you think about Saudi Arabia and they do behead people for things that we in the West wouldn't see to be crimes. The only difference with IS is they like to televise it and make sure everybody knows about it in terms of that execution, you know, and the Americans are allied with the Saudis in a very, very serious way. And I think that's a nexus that has to be really looked at very closely, because it's a relationship between Saudi Arabia and the West, and the standard of human rights that is in Saudi Arabia is really appalling, and yet, you know, that's a key ally for the West, and it's something.
I was going to say, because we need their oil, but there's another need that came to my mind as well when we're talking about, do we sit down and talk to terrorists, whoever the terrorists are, do we sit down and talk to them? And somebody asked Nelson Mandela when he came out of prison, was he going to talk to, did he like de Klerk? And he said, it's irrelevant whether I like de Klerk or not, but I do need him. And it takes two to sit down and sort things out. And we've got to, and I think you see that horrific as ISIS have been, and other groups as well, but they're good at the publicity thing. They're good at that. We've got to try to understand what's going on there. You talk about the symptom and the causes, that they are a symptom of unrest and dissatisfaction, and we have to try and understand. Empathising is one thing. It doesn't mean that we're agreeing with what they do, but we have got to try to understand.
You said last question before we kind of go for a break, Mary. And you said earlier on that you're not a pessimist, which means that you're an optimist. So, are you optimistic? Just kind of working out in my head. Are you optimistic about the future of Syria? I mean, like, you know,
I've absolutely got to be. And the thing about being a travel writer these days, it's happened to me before that there has been an outbreak of violence and so on, mostly after I have gone, but. I think the travel writer now is actually looking at history and writing about history as it's happening. And that's in my head the whole time. I think of Syria and the Syria that I knew, which is very, very different from the Syria now. And I feel I've got to keep faith with that Syria, because it's the people who make Syria. And never, ever in all my travels did I ever feel the need to ask somebody what group do they belong. I did once ask a Bedouin woman, because I was hoping to get a bed and her tent for the night, and to ask her which group she belonged to, which she wasn't a Bedouin, it was another tribe. But I never, ever was asked myself about what political group or what religious group I belonged to or any kind of sect at all, and nor did I ask other people. It just didn't seem to be there.
From the people on the ground then, Jane Anne and Barry, I mean, are you optimistic? Given that you're hearing every single day from your people out there on the ground what things are like, you're getting reports in about, like, I mean, hospitals you support being bombed, you're hearing about more people moving north, trying to get out of the country, and, like, what they're going through. Is it possible from your point of view to be optimistic?
I think it's very hard to be optimistic now, I think. We saw in... I think it was in 2015, we were treating 900 women and children a week for war wounded injuries. You know, when you look at the scale of it, it's absolutely massive. But then, you know, I was talking to one of our teams today, and we have seen, a definite decrease in the level of violence since this, cessation of violence rather than a ceasefire. But cessation of violence has happened, I think, over the last 10 days or 2 weeks, that, yeah, the number of attacks has definitely gone down. The number of airstrikes has gone down, but it's still happening, you know. So we can remain, as talks hopefully progress, that the scale of violence will continue to decrease, but there needs to be a huge political will to do so. And I think that, you know, we have a situation now where it hasn't happened since, I think, 1953 in North Korea, where you have 4 out of the 5 permanent members of the UN Security Council are all engaged in an active conflict together. And they've all said, you know, the same countries, you know, still are passing resolutions that they will protect the civilians of the same country that they're actively fighting in a conflict with. So it's a complete contradiction, and you need to have a political will to actually really resolve this issue in order to reduce the civilian casualties and the level of violence today.
Okay. Barry?
Yeah, I'd be optimistic for the reasons I mentioned. I think that the Americans and the Russians are sort of beginning to develop some common ground. The European Union is in absolute panic about it, taking it seriously for the first time. And it's interesting, I don't know if you've come across this, Jane Anne, but there haven't been many events like this, actually, throughout the war. There's only been one or two academic things, like a symposium or a conference on Syria in this country, whereas, you know, in other conflicts, there would be a lot of activity, certainly in Iraq. I mean, there's 100,000 people on the streets in Dublin about the Iraq war. But there's been very little public manifestation of anger or that this is going on and on and on. But now there is a bit more pressure coming from ordinary people saying, well, this has to be solved at source. You know, fair enough about the refugees and terrorist threat, you have to be vigilant, but this is an issue that people are beginning to take an interest in. And
what do you put that down to? I mean, I'm not going to say lack of interest, because it's not a lack of interest, but, like, you're right. I mean, it was when you say it, you suddenly say, okay, 100,000 people are out in the streets of Dublin marching about Iraq, but was it because it was a much easier to understand narrative? You know, America bad.
I think the left in Ireland, I mean, just been getting into trouble here now, I know, but they take an anti, you know, once America is in the spotlight, that's fine, you know, and it makes it very straightforward. But where there are more complex issues, it doesn't engage people to the same extent. I think the Middle East is immediately dismissed as a place that's inherently violent anyway, in some minds, people think that. They think everyone's as bad as each other. There's this kind of conflation of all the parties as being identical. And I think, people react to natural disasters very generously, if you want to talk about sort of fundraising, that kind of thing. But when it comes to man-made disasters, even though we cause them, there doesn't seem to be the same upset and annoyance and anger about it. But, you know, what happened in Bosnia was you had this kind of Srebrenica situation where suddenly there was a massive public outcry, and the electoral equation changed for the politicians. They had to do something about it rather than do nothing. And I thought that had happened when the Aylan Kurdi picture went all around the world. Yeah. I thought, well, hang on a second. Here we have now the energy is coming from the public. Now the politicians begin to do something about it. And then the Russian intervention happened. So there's definitely more diplomatic activity now than there ever has been. So I would be optimistic in short.
I have to say that you're talking about the apparent disinterest in Ireland in what's going on in Syria. It does not work the other way. There are a number of times I was stopped in the street by usually young guys, because they're more prepared to talk to strangers and so on, wanted to practice their English, and as soon as we got started, they would tell me, they would quote bits of Joyce, they would tell me the whole story of the Plough and the Stars, and their education was... was fantastic, far greater than anything that we might know about theirs. And also a lot of them had had practical experience. They had lived here in Ireland. There was one guy, I went into a hospital in Baghdad where the children were suffering terribly from the effects of depleted uranium. And I was horrified by what I saw, but this young doctor came down the ward to me, all smiles. I said, how can you be smiling? And he said, you're from Ireland. And I said, yeah. And he said, top of the morning to you, top of the morning. And how's Gay Byrne? And as a young boy, his parents had come here as both doctors, and they had worked in hospitals here in Dublin, and he had gone to school in Dublin.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not a one-way thing. They really are interested in Ireland and have an educated view of the place, because they think we're still fighting the English, but I mean, that's just...
Okay, that seems a good note to press the pause button for a few minutes. Yeah, so we break for 10 minutes, back at 22:08 for some questions from the audience. But right now, a round of applause, please, for Jane Anne, Barry and Barry. Hi, folks. Welcome back here to Banter on Syria. Thank you very much for your patience and listening very intently to the first half of the discussion. Now it's your turn. So if you've got any questions for the panel, just put your hand up and we'll hear from you. So don't be shy.
Yep, yes. For sure.
Can I just ask a question of Mary? You were saying when you were there in about 2010 that the sign on the car was saying...
to be Syrian.
Exactly. And that was in Damascus.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, do you think you would have gotten the same response up north, saying we are proud to be Syrian, we like Assad, but we want change, or would the humour up north have been anti-Assad at that time?
I wasn't particularly aware of it, but I was aware that people would... I wasn't aware of it particularly, but what I did notice is that people were prepared to make a few jokes about the president and so on, which implied a sort of relaxing of their attitudes towards him. I think the proud to be Syrian thing was quite unusual. That's what drew me into the building to ask, you know, why they had it there. So it was an expression of a desire, definitely. Yeah.
Next question. Yeah, woman here.
I'm just from Irish Syria Solidarity Movement, and I just wanted to ask the panel regarding, it was really Barry's point about the lack of reaction in Ireland in general. And we have had quite a number of events, but they were very badly attended. Like last November, we had a Syrian speaker over from the people who rescued the bodies under the rubble of the collapsed buildings from the Syria Civil Defence. And the attendance was really very very few. It wasn't covered by the Irish Times, even though we sent in a press release. He was on This Week, actually This Week. Then we had a series of other speakers. Dr. Nader Hashemi, he came over at his own expense because he was not pleased at all with the media coverage in Ireland. He challenged the Irish Times to a debate, and it was Paddy Smith who came. Well, you know, Paddy seemed to more or less agree with him about certain things. But he wasn't interviewed by the Irish Times. But, you know, I think myself that there is a problem with the media coverage. I would single out the Irish Times main reporter on Syria, who's Michael Johnson. And I think there should be a media analysis done immediately. There was a media analysis done on TV3 last night of the elections, and they seem to have come up with very professional analysis in just a few days. And I think for 4 years of effective extermination, the UN said there was extermination of the civilian population by Assad in February of this year. The policy of the Assyrian government amounted to extermination. That word is there in big black letters, extermination. And I think we deserve to cover this war a lot better, seeing as we're going to be affected by it, because we're going to have to take a lot more refugees. We've taken hardly anybody yet. And we're going to be affected in terms of it's going to be the debate for years to come, because it's just a cataclysmic, you know, it's like a humanitarian catastrophe. So I would just point that out. And also, the second question, thank you, is I would also think about prime time, because when Kosovo war was on, there was a lot of coverage, a lot of understanding of where people came from, a lot of empathy, the people were on TV, etc. But because journalists can't go into Syria, the excuse is then we don't cover it at all. And I would pinpoint the drive time man, whose name Freddie Keane, he was very good. He went to the border and he said, just be aware that what's going on inside Syria is so terrible. He was just following Kobani.
Yeah.
But he was very good because he said what's happening behind Kobani is, you know, what Assad is doing. We're not able to cover because we will be killed if we go there after the lady was killed in the Sunday Times.
Yeah, Mary Colvin.
Correct, yeah. So I do think, I'm ashamed myself, I have to say, as an Irish person, I have a lot of Syrian context, and I'm ashamed of the coverage here. Now that we're doing reflections on the 1916 Rising, I'm ashamed of our main newspaper. Fintan O'Toole is going to be talking in the National Concert Hall this month about reflections on Roger Casement, human rights, and the idea of a universal dignity. And I find Michael Janssen's reporting undignified. And it's she supported the Russian intervention on the 29th of September of 2015. She was cheerleader. It's the best thing ever, or, you know, more or less. And I think there needs to be a balance, even. Barry Anderson's got opinion thing in it. But that's not enough to counter her.
Okay, like first of all, I'm just going to hand over. I'm not going to defend the Irish Times. I mean, I write for the Irish Times, but I'm not the Irish Times. I'm not the old dame of kind of where we are now, Tower Street. So I'm not going to defend them. But like, you know, it's you put your finger, I suppose, on one of the things, which is the great excuse we can give, which is that okay, we can't get into the country, but that's no excuse really. So I'm just going to put it over to the three panelists because I mean I'm just the moderator here, fading quickly out the back into the background. But like, you know, I'm not going to give an excuse for the media coverage. What do you think? I mean, as like you say, with let's start with you, Jane, and Barry, as the kind of people who are involved with aid organisations who rely on media coverage in order to kind of like bring in more money to help your people out there. Do you think the media coverage has been as bad as that woman points out, and what do you think is behind it, if that's the case?
Well, I think, and I think Barry probably agreed with me on this, I think I have one communications guy, I think, who is exhausted from trying to get media coverage for us, but, you know, we ourselves are always looking for, are dealing with the media. We have found them at different levels to be quite open to actually hearing what we have to say and to having people on the ground. Now, it's not easy, it's definitely not easy to get coverage at all, and you have to really push all the time, try and find different ways and different angles that people might be interested in order to have something different, because it's this whole thing of, well, the war's been going on for 5 years, so what else is new, kind of thing. I think then, you know, you have to, from like the, we've always tried to kind of get the opinion as well of people on the ground out there. But, you know, some stuff is out of our control. We did one, we had actually a prime time on one of our search and rescue boats, you know, and we facilitated them to go on that. But they put the piece together with the piece on ISIS, you know. So it was, you know, in the big terror threat to Europe and intertwined with us, you know, rescuing people in the Mediterranean. It's like, okay, that's not quite the, you know, you're convoluting a few messages here, and you know that you also have responsibility, you know, to actually treat.
And they're starving to death in the places under siege. I mean, they're starving to death.
Yeah.
And I mean, I would, you know, I think the humanitarian organisations need to start screaming. I mean, why isn't the UN? We give all our aid to the UN and the Irish Red Cross, because I know a student doctor who asked for a small amount of aid in 2012, and he said no, we only give it to the UN. So the main plank of Irish foreign policy is humanitarian aid, which goes to the UN. So the serious questioning to be done at the UN, they've received a lot of criticism in recent weeks and months about how, you know, they're complicit with the Assad regime. Some members of the UN, allegedly, it's all over the American media. Dr. Sparrow, who's married to Ken Roth, she has been scathing in her criticism. Why isn't that in the Irish Times? Why isn't it on RT main news? It was referred to in this week. On Sunday, a slight.
Yeah. In fairness, like Jen Ann, it's like that's not a question she can answer, you know. In fairness to anyone on the panel, it's not. The people who can answer that question are people you know exactly who the people are. It's Paddy Smith. It's basically John McManus. The opinion editor in the Irish Times. It's whoever the commissioning editors are in all those kind of programs. They're the people who make those decisions. So it's not something that the panel can answer. Barry, do you want to speak up? No?
I mean, again, like Jane Ann, we're always trying to get coverage of it, and it is difficult. And, you know, I remember I met Samantha Power, the US ambassador to the UN, and we were discussing, you know, where's the energy going to come from in this thing? And the prediction was it would be a photograph or it would be an incident. And it was like that in Bosnia when they showed the prison camps and, you know, it was immediately resonated with images of the Holocaust because they were people, barbed wire, rib cage Muslims who had been treated abominably by the Serbs, and that certainly created energy and created electoral, you know, energy that wasn't there previously. So the media are not going to report these things, unfortunately. And you did hit the nail on the head, Valerie. By the way, Valerie has been pushing this heroically for the last two or three years longer than other issues. But the point is that there are no journalists inside to report. What we're getting is YouTube the whole time, which is user-verified output, and there isn't much credibility to that with the best will in the world. People want Jeremy Thompson, Kate Adie, John Simpson. They want somebody standing there in a flak jacket saying, this is happening, this is what I saw today. They want Paul Cunningham, Tony Connolly. They want these people that they have that have credibility. And that's not there at the moment. And it's
your story full. They're supposed to be verifying.
Yeah. But it's fine for you know, fire trucks and stuff like that. But it's not really, you know, Syria
it's much harder for them to verify stuff than they would normally have. I'm going to come to you in a second for a question, but I want to kind of talk because there is one media person on the panel. That's you, Mary.
That's me. Yeah.
So can you defend the media trade?
I'm not going to talk about myself at all, but this does give me an opportunity to refer to. This is a piece of paper which I printed out from the website of Paul Rogers, Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University. And I went to Bradford. I did an MA there a long, long time ago, but I've always kept in touch. And Paul was a great guy. He wasn't professor then. He went off to America to investigate something, and he came back absolutely impressed and excited with the ease with which he was able to access different documents and so on that he would not have been able to do had he been in England. Anyway, this comes from some kind of correspondence that he's had with a young guy. I keep saying young. I'll drop that. And he had this man was a member of what Paul Rogers calls a second letter from an Islamic State adherent in Iraq, operating in the part of Iraq controlled by the movement. You can hear the use of vocabulary there is very, very different from anything that you might read in the paper. Anyway, he has, this guy had done an MA at SOAS and had lived in England for 3 years and also in America, and had then decided he thought the idea of establishing an Islamic caliphate was something that he wanted to be part of. So he was injured in some incident, and his superiors decided that he would be better employed working with the media. And he set about setting himself up. He said, I now lead a small team that monitors Western media and government output to prepare briefings for the leadership, that's his own leadership of the caliphate. I have three people working for me, and our whole section numbers more than 20, covering all the major Western languages as well as Chinese and Russian, and with excellent communication systems that have so far been entirely unaffected by the numerous US air strikes. And he goes on to say more. But that should be a warning to the media here in this country that there's serious opposition and serious work being done by at least one member of ISIS. Okay. And it's not being done here.
Okay. Question, gentleman here, third row.
I'd like to ask the panel, what effect would a British exit from the EU have on the international response to the crisis in Syria?
Oh.
That's a trick question.
Good question.
I just don't know the answer.
Yeah, I'm not an expert in that area at all.
Do you mean in terms of the refugees, or do you mean in terms of what's going on the ground?
The panel were saying earlier that the European response had been inadequate. And I was just wondering if Britain left the EU, would that
change?
Let's just say that, I mean, Britain are not part of the justice and home affairs elements of the European Union. They have, as Ireland, are not obliged under the Justice Home Affairs elements, I don't know what the correct terminology, they're not part of Schengen, and therefore they write their own rules in terms of the refugees that they take, and they have committed to taking 20,000 over a period of 5 years, I believe. So I think their exit from the situation wouldn't necessarily affect that in and of itself. But there's a wider problem, an existential problem for the European Union, where it is beginning to fracture under the pressure of the refugees and under the, you know, the mistakes that are being made. And, you know, so Schengen is under pressure. And the terrible, the sad part of it is the European Union was created out of the embers, the ashes of the Second World War, when so many people from the EU countries and beyond perished. And it was the one lasting monument from the European from that war. And now it's been torn asunder by something so disproportionately small compared to what it was generated from. So, you know, the European Union collapsing or under such strain at this particular moment in time, you know, Brexit is a sort of a symptom of that. I don't actually happen to believe that Brexit will happen. I think they'll stay in my opinion, actually.
We'll come back to that one in June. Next question. Yep.
As a preamble, may I say I was in Syria way back in, originally in 1961. There were four of us driving there at the time. We were driving further on. And the Syrian people we found to be absolutely charming, delightful, hospitable, kind people, as they still seem to be. But there had been some kind of a civil war, because we were told there was no point in driving down from Turkey to cross the border into Syria. Does anybody know anything about it? Anyway, when we got to the border that morning, they had lifted, they opened the border again. Does anybody know anything about what happened in early 1960s in Syria? That's a preamble. The question I want to put to everybody, I want to answer it myself.
I really like this.
What is the largest, greatest motivating power in warring on other nations? Well, you must know what it is. It is money, greed, and the arms industry. This is exactly why people are dying in Syria. This is why people died in Iraq, why people died in Afghanistan, why people died. You have the so-called West, which operates to a large extent on profits from the arms industries, perpetrating wars, and more wars. Now, admittedly, Syria is a very complex matter, to be honest. But at least Russia is being honest about what it's doing in Syria. And it did go in, as you say, legitimately on the invitation of the president of Syria. And of course there are other factors going on in that area too. Religion and more religion. You have the Islam is going through a cleric here in town, Dr. Umar al-Qadri, said the Islam is going through the Christian Reformation right now, he said, and they're tearing each other apart. And that is also part of the factor in what is happening there. But at the end of it all, I would say hypocrisy and the arms industry is what is exactly causing so much pain, suffering throughout the world, and Syria is going through more than most of it. And to our shame, Ireland is not doing its bit in relation to taking refugees. We're taking a handful of refugees. Europe is disgracing itself and going totally against the United Nations High Commission for Refugees in now knocking off borders and so on. Really and truly, the West is disgraceful, disgusting and despicable. And unfortunately, Ireland gets tied in with the West. We're totally tied in with the West, especially in relation to American troops coming through Shannon Airport. They've been coming through for the last decade. 3 million have passed through in the last 2 years on their way, not to distribute daisies and dandelions. They're going to kill the people throughout the world. And our country, Ireland, is part of the slaughter that is going on. We're totally complicit. And our Department of Foreign Affairs is no longer the Department of Foreign Affairs, it's the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. That is the answer to everything. Trade, money, greed, and the arms industry, rather than politics.
Thank you very much. Woman here in the front row. Woman here. Yep.
Just, I suppose my question is just, I suppose, security related. Just given the amount of terrorist attacks that's happened in Europe, I suppose with London and Madrid, and then Paris happened, I suppose, in the middle most recently. And there's a huge fear that the lady behind me mentioned extermination. It has been, security experts have said, that's what the recruitment, the sympathisers for the Islamic State, it's akin to what happened in Germany. And it seems that Europe has gone into lockdown and into defence mode because they're scared. ISIS have said the infidels will come in with the refugees. And Angela Merkel, it seems, is in a very awkward position. She's under pressure. And I'm just wondering, like, the humanitarian crisis on one hand, and then you've got the terrorist threat, which is huge. So what do you do? Like, what would you advise her to do, or how do you resolve the situation?
Well, I think, you know, I've only been following the news as much as anybody else in terms of the threats, you know, and a lot of the initial media was in fact incorrect around people coming in with Syrian passports. You know, a lot of the terrorists involved in the attack are homegrown terrorists who indeed did go over to Syria but in fact came home, or, you know, or empathise with ISIS or, you know, whatever. But I mean, it's it needs to be two separate issues, you know, it needs to be dealt with separately. I think the problem that we have is that there's this kind of interchangeable conversation about refugees and terrorists, and it's actually it's kind of missing the whole point. You know, we have a situation and we have a responsibility for the millions of people that are coming over, and it's not even just, you know, through Greece. We're talking about people who are passing through Libya who, you know, are actually have no way out apart from getting on a boat, or, you know, who are in like torture camps in Libya and can find a way out. And, you know, the first, you know, welcome to them when they arrive is, you know, suspicion that they are indeed a terrorist. And I think that, you know, of course every state has to implement their own level of security measures in terms of being able to, you know, screen people who are seeking asylum. But, you know, they should follow a process, and people should be at a minimum given a temporary level of protection until that comes through. And that is not what's happening right now at the EU level. And what's happening now is just, you know, this kind of active policy of deterrence of, you know, essentially not really addressing any of the core issues at all, not trying to find any real solutions. And, you know, you just have to look at, you know, what happened in Calais when four Syrian children were eventually, you know, able to get across to the UK after they were taken to the court, you know, that it had to go through the courts and the legal systems. And it was, you know, it was determined to be completely illegal what the UK were doing. So, you know, you have to look at what the response is happening is completely inadequate across the EU. And I think that, you know, of course there are some fears that are warranted, but there needs to be a process in place. And at the moment, it's complete chaos, I would say.
So I would say that, you know, ISIS, as a terrorist organization, their aim is to terrify everybody. And so they send out messages saying that we have loads of people who are going on the boats and they're going up through the Balkan corridors and they're going to come and kill you all. But the European anti-terror chief in the middle of last year said, in fact, the EU is sending, you know, there's a lot of people leaving the EU and going to fight in the Syrian civil war. So they're actually going the other way. They're joining ISIS. They're French, they're British, they're Belgian, they're Irish, and they're going in much greater numbers than are coming here. And what we, you know, so you go back to the media question. Somebody rings me up, we want to talk about the Syrian thing, we want to talk about ISIS and terrorism in Europe. I thought, okay, well, you can if you want, but I'm going to talk about the fact that, in fact, these guys are going the other direction as well. And the terrorists are not actually from Syria for the most part. Most of them are born in the banlieue around Paris, or they're born in Bradford or Birmingham. That's where they're coming from. But because there are one guy with a passport down in the Greek islands, then we are going to tear ourselves apart in the European Union. Mm. That's the first point I'd make. The second point I'd make is that proportionality has been lost here. Because you mentioned Madrid, London, and France, Paris. And they are massive incidents, and MI5 has identified 5 or 6 incidents that they frustrated throughout 2015. So there's lots of people with bad intentions, and you can't stop being vigilant. But less than 500 people have died in terrorist attacks in the entire EU in 20 years, right? Now, remember what I said, like 20 million died in the Second World War from the EU countries. So we set up the EU. You know, less than 500 die over 20 years and the EU's falling apart. So there's a lack of proportionality. We've lost any sight of what is actually the, you know, should be the equation here. So that would be my view. I mean, I've made this point before, and I think it bears repeating that, you know, that they are, there are threats, that you have to be vigilant, but it's, you know, the reaction here, the impact on the political complexion of Europe is way out of proportion to the actual threat, I would say. I mean, there's more chance of getting hit by a tram than getting killed by ISIS. You know, that's the truth of it.
Luckily, that's no reason for staying at home, though. Or I'd never move. No, I think that you put your finger on it. There is a fear, isn't there, of the unknown, and that's what the terrorist represents. And the more we get to know people, and to, even within our own small communities, that we mingle and we open our doors and we enter other people's doors. And the whole point about the title of my book is My Home is Your Home, is what Syrian people will say to you when you go in to their house, they say Beiti Baghdad, and we say the same thing, don't we? Say, make yourself at home.
Yeah.
We do need to do a lot more, even if it's only in your own small parish that you do it. And it's just a pity. Sorry, it's just a pity to me that that the title of the book doesn't translate better here in Ireland.
Sky, would down there with the strip jumper? Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, my question is about the UN. I don't know if it's out of scope, but regarding the UN Human Rights Council and Saudi Arabia's membership there, is that not quite corruption, or how do you think that ever came about, given their Sharia law and likely things with ISIS?
That's another good question.
Outsource the question. No, it's a very good question, and the UN is in a bit of disarray at the moment. And you know, the UN was set up to prevent wars between nations after the Second World War. That's its opening preamble. We will the nations of the earth will get together. We will to prevent war for future generations. And patently, it is not able to do that because there are five permanent members of the Security Council, each of them victors in the Second World War, which is relevant to today. It's hard to believe what it could be. But that is determining, you know, so every case that comes before the Security Council is determined in terms of the national interest of each of the permanent members and not in terms of the merits of any case that comes before it. You know, downstream from the Security Council, there are other elements to the the UN, such as UNICEF, World Health Organization, World Food Programme, Human Rights Council, UN High Commissioner for Refugees. There's all sorts of bits and pieces of the UN that actually do reasonably good work. And Ireland actually was on the member of the Human Rights Council of the UN for the last few years. But I mean, the one criticism I would say about Ireland, I mean, funding Ireland has been quite good. Commitments, even though we are outside Schengen and the Justice and Home Affairs in Ireland, not bad on refugees in the EU context. But in terms of advocacy, that's the one massive gap I see in terms of political leadership in Ireland. You know, I mean, do you think of the endless historical analogies we could draw upon to give credibility and authenticity to an Irish voice in an international forum? And can you think of any Irish politician that has said something memorable, credible, authentic, that has resonated? I mean, think of Mary Robinson, right? Somalia War, 1990, or the famine in 1992, 93. And she, you know, what she said, what she did, rippled throughout the world, you know, because Ireland has some, you know, cachet.
Yeah.
So that's one point I would make. I'm not sure I'm really answering your question about Saudi Arabia, but it's certainly, you know, there's issues there.
I think there's also the question, I haven't been looked at the figures up to date, the number of countries that don't pay their dues to the UN, so they're very short of cash the whole time. Did you say that Ireland had been one of the ones that had forked out?
In the Syrian humanitarian response, Ireland has been reasonably good. You know, it has met all its targets, and although it's paying it to the UN, which is a bit of a sinkhole, you know, where you should... We would argue, well, I don't know if you take UN money, do you?
No, we don't.
No, yeah. We'll take it. Yeah. You don't take Irish money.
No, we don't take any government funding for anything in Syria or any Syrian refugees. Yeah. Just because of the political.
We would argue it's more efficient for the Irish government to fund NGOs because they are, they're much closer to the ground and much less, much more nimble. You know, the goals, the concerns. I think we rather than give it to the United Nations. And so the money that very much, but you can't undermine the UN because then you end up in a situation like the World Health Organization around Ebola, around which Jane Anne would be more expert than me. But if you don't fund these organizations, they're not able to do their work. And that's, so it's a bit of a fine line, I'm not sure.
Got time for what, two more questions. So, one person behind me here.
Yeah, just with reference to what you said there about Irish politicians, you don't really hear the voice of Irish politicians about where the I forgot the names of the two boats now that are in the Mediterranean, but where does the impetus for them being where they are, where does that come from within the Irish system?
I met with Minister Coveney a couple of times because MSF had the search and rescue boats in the Mediterranean and actually worked alongside the Irish Navy, sometimes doing joint rescues. And I do think that is a very positive contribution that Ireland's been able to make, and we're really advocating that they actually continue that now again into 2016, and that it is carried by the EU member states rather than an NGO or such as MSF. But I do actually believe, I'm not a big Fine Gaeler or anything like that, but I do believe that he believed in it actually, and I think that unfortunately is. It's a good thing, that he did have that level of initiative. But on the other hand, I'm not sure if there was another Minister for Defence, if there would have been the same response, And I think that we have to, I agree, Barry, I think that, Ireland is always very financially generous. I think that we did make a huge contribution with the search and rescue vessels. But I also think there was a massive opportunity by the Irish government that was lost. You had, the President of Ireland being very vocal, very strong on what our duty is towards refugees, towards the people of Syria. You had a massive outpouring, last September, October, from individuals in Ireland offering their homes, offering, saying that we are behind you and actually this support. And yet our response was pretty muted, and like that, I've yet to hear any politician, let alone Taoiseach, speak publicly about Syria or indeed about Syrian refugees as well.
And it's just to add to that, sorry, Mary, was that, you're the Canadian Prime Minister. It was very, very symbolic. And it didn't have to amount to much. But politics is about symbols and, imagery. And he set the tone and he said, look, this is what we're going to do. Whereas David Cameron is talking about swarms, this kind of insect infestation. That language belongs in the 18th century, by contrast. So the government can do a lot in terms of advocacy, I think. I mean, they can begin to set the tone for what we as a country, what our ethical framework is around these issues, I would say.
One last question. Woman here.
It's really a follow-on from that, because that's the thing I suppose I'm most interested in. In terms of what's happening in Syria and the total lack of any kind of political engagement here, engagement by the people, by journalism or by politicians. And I'm just wondering about what the panel thinks about that, because, we know that 95% of the deaths in Syria are attributable to Assad. So Assad is the terrorist in Syria. Gold brought over the Caesar photographs to Ireland, which are evidence of over 6,000 deaths by starvation and torture in custody. So it's not that the effort hasn't been made. Those, did you bring them to the Doyle, or they were brought to the House of Commons, I know.
They were in Congress and lots of places. Yeah.
So, and yet nothing has happened. I have not heard Simon Coveney and the Chits, and I've been on Twitter saying, well done, wonderful, thrilled to see it happening, that we're doing one lousy, bloody thing, which is sending our ships into the Mediterranean. What is it? And I suppose my question, because it is a question, it will become a question, is, you've seen so many situations where there has been engagement, and here's one where there's none.
Yeah.
And what's your understanding of why that is, but much more importantly, what can be done to change that?
Good,
because you're absolutely right, we're a tiny country, but we do have authority on the international stage, and we're doing nothing. So what could make a difference?
Good question. Good question to end it with. What can be done? What would you like to see us doing, for example, Sharon?
Well, I'd like that. I think that at I would like to see the Irish government being a lot more advocating on the situation at an EU level, at a global level, at least making some level of contribution as to what should be, at least how we should manage, you know, the refugees, or at least how we should uphold international humanitarian law and, you know, the right of refugees to seek asylum, you know. But yeah. I'm not sure that that's going to come from the Irish government anytime soon. But
not at all. And like this leads on to kind of Barry then. Like, I mean, like, you know, what Jane just described is kind of that advocacy thing is something very simple. It doesn't cost a lot. It doesn't get any votes.
No, it definitely doesn't. I know that for a fact. But it can't be all about electoralism. I mean, that it has to be around an ethic. And in fairness to Michael D, you referenced him. He started this ethics initiative in Ireland, and it really resounded. But it was the right thing to do. And what can people do? You see, I mean, if we all took a view that, well, we're only one person, then nobody do anything and nothing would happen, and you know we all know that. But I think just to say to people in the room, you'll never know how encouraging it is for ordinary Syrians to know that there's a room full of people here in a place in Dublin talking about this, thinking about it. I mean, that means a huge amount. For example, to our staff, you know, we'll write something about this on a blog or something tomorrow. That really, really is significant. You'll never see the benefit of it, but they will take great encouragement, solace from it. Okay. And you know, we do these things; they matter.
Okay, so that's advocacy, just doing something. What would you add to that?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Butt in there. Both of you have been very much involved in the practical aspect of the situation in Syria, and Valerie, that I don't know, but is organises an event on Saturday. Sorry. I think, is it? Yeah, you know, I think getting people on the street. I'm not a great one for politics at all, but I do often get on the street because I think that's a visible, very very visible to people, expressing what your views are, and that kind of thing has got to be done a lot more. But when it comes to the last election, I wonder if it's too late now, but you know, we may have another one. if everybody were to say, everybody here, and maybe find, you know, three or four other friends who'd be committed to do it, to asking politicians who are standing what are their views and what would they do, so that although you say, and I agree with you, that Syria is not a big spinner for votes and all the rest of it, unfortunately. But it might be a way of raising the awareness of the politicians or the would-be politicians that it is something that matters and that is important to people.
Yeah, it was definitely one of the questions I wanted to ask politicians who came to my door looking for my vote in the last couple of weeks. Sadly, no politician came anywhere near my door the last couple of weeks. So thank you very much to the panel for taking the time to come along. Thank you all very much. If you want to get a copy of Mary's book, she's got some limited copies down there. More information about Banter on thisisbanter.com. We've got more Banters coming up in April as part of Music Town. Just like to say a huge thanks to Mary, to Barry, and to Jane Anne. Thank you very much for your time. Thanks to Barry, Jane Anne and Mary for joining us at Banter. This podcast was produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. Check out thisisbanter.com for news of what we're up to at Banter. Plus, you can also listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye and take care.